Thank you, Tony. Yeah, so finally, I'm in a place where I don't have to move for the last 5 years. So, yeah, so of course, I acknowledge the EPSRC, which our, it's the NSF of the UK, for those of you that don't know what EPSRC is. And my fellows and my grants from them, which allowed me to do the work. Also, I want to thank my students for this particular work. It's a Hugh Prize that graduated. And as a proud advisor, I have to say this, he got the award at the UCL for outstanding AMO research, research in AMO physics. And my student, my current student, who is sitting over there, Hai Chen, and my former postdoc, Konstantinos Lazaro. Okay, so you have heard the story a lot, but nevertheless, since my work is this part of my work, which is going to be classical, is based on the three-step model. Let me go briefly through it and just say that, of course, recollision is the driving force of attosecond science, and it was a model that was mainly introduced by Paul Corkum in 1993. And again, the idea is that you have a particle that is basically tunneling in the first step. So this is a quantum semi-classical step here. So it's tunneling through the Coulomb barrier, which is lowered by the laser field, which you see over here. And then the particle, once it tunnels, it can move freely in the classical field and returns back and can do mainly two things. One thing is it can recombine with the core, and then we have a generation of high harmonics. I don't have to do anything with this part, so my work is not on high harmonic generation. Or it can give energy to the remaining electrons in the core and actually also interact with the nucleus as well. And then the electrons can escape. And so that's what I basically work on. So it's a E2E kind of process, but caused by the field. And so that's what I'll be talking about today. So let me start, we might motivate the work. It's what I'm going to talk about is molecules in strong fields. But before I do that, let me motivate a little bit our techniques. So this is actually the first thing that I have done when I got into strong field physics in 2008. And what you see over here is an experimental result. This is correlated correlated momenta. This particular plot that you see over here is well, by Andrew Stout et al. In the group of Paul Corkum. But Robert Mooshammer has also at the same time, they had a similar paper, but they gave a different explanation for what I'm going to say right now. Anyway, so this is the correlated momenta. So we have a helium, two electrons. We have a linearly polarized field. And what we are plotting is the momenta of the two electrons along the direction of the field once the electrons have escaped. And so what was interesting at the time was the, this V-shape structure or ear structure, everybody calls it something else, which I have to say was first predicted by Ken Taylor in a paper that they have in 2006, theoretically. So it was a full ab initio quantum mechanical calculation, and so that's what they have predicted. And they have conjectured at the time that it was due, this V-shape structure was interesting. Why? Because the electron gains energy more than could actually gain from just an interaction with the field. And so they were trying to understand where does the electron gain its energy from. And so the conjecture was that basically you have an electron who doesn't just come back and get out. So basically tunnels, is driven in the field, and then gets out. That's not what is happening. What they have conjectured is that it is coming back, strongly interacts with the remaining electron and the nucleus, and completely backscatters. So it reverses velocity and goes back where it came from. And so that was one advantage, of course, of classical calculations. And in this case, I emphasize this is with Coulomb interaction fully accounted for. So it is the actual Coulomb force, and this is very important because we are describing an interaction with the nucleus, so we have strong backscattering from the nucleus. So the advantage of classical calculations is that, of course, you can test if this is the case or not. And so I could easily test if it was, if this V-shaped structure, which you can see that we can reproduce here, is coming from electrons that completely backscatter from the nucleus. And that was the case, that's what we found, and that was actually my first paper in strong field physics. Actually, that's not exactly true. Okay, but yes. Yeah.
Just to Cantillon's prediction,
yes.
As I recall, was for a higher frequency than the experiments.
That was 800, he had 400.
Yeah, right.
That's right, absolutely. But it was exactly the same reason.
The same shape.
It's exactly the same, it's the same shape, more or less, and it's the same reason. It was because of backscattering from the electrons. Of course, also, Ken at the time, you know, they didn't know where it was coming from, but I'm just saying for the record that it was first Ken who has observed this and not the experimentalist. I mean, the experimentalist came afterwards to verify that this was indeed the case. Okay, so that was the first thing, and then something which was, I have to say, I was also even surprised. I met Ken at a conference, in your conference in Montreal in 2009. And so Ken came to me and he said, Agapi, why don't we do something together? And so here's what we did together. So this is a double ionization yield of helium in a strong laser field. So you have 400 nanometers. And we have done it for three intensities, so here I'm just plotting two of those. Now, what are these intensities? These intensities that you see here cover a wide range. So the ionization energy of helium plus is less than 317 ponderomotive energy. This is for the one on the right, so this is actually the high intensity limit, or the one that you see on the left, where the ionization energy is actually not much bigger, but definitely bigger than 3.17 UP. So you are getting into the quantum, really into the quantum regime. And so now what you see here, we are plotting the double ionization yield, so we register the electrons that have doubly ionized, and we are plotting that as a function of the total energy. So we sum up the energy, the final energy of the two electrons, and plot it in UP. Okay, so it doesn't depend on the intensity. That's the reason we are plotting in UP. And basically, you can see that Ken Taylor's results are the black dots. My results are the squares. So it was an amazing agreement, in our opinion. That was a paper in NJP in 2011. I have to emphasize, though, this is not an absolute scale here. Okay, so I'm not comparing on an absolute scale. In our case, we use, for the tunneling part, we are using a decay theory for the atoms. But the differential is right on. So that's my motivation now for what is going to follow, which is molecules. And so let me, again, motivate this technique. So why are we doing classical things? I'm doing classical calculations in the case for two reasons, actually, I would say. Or mainly one, really. But okay, so strongly driven molecules, as you have heard these days, are very tough systems to track down and to actually solve, to address, because you have many degrees of freedom, and we are not only dealing with electronic degrees of freedom, but also with the nuclear degrees of freedom. So what I'm going to talk about today is a full fragmentation of molecules. So we account both for electronic and nuclear motion on the same footing without any approximation, of course, in a classical framework. Okay, so the first motivation is that this is something that is very difficult. Right now, for the systems that I'm going to end up with, there are no results in three dimensions. Okay, so when we get to triatomics, there are no quantum mechanical calculations, except, I think, Andre, yours, is it in 1D for two electrons getting out? Andre is not... Andre, in triatomics, do you have 1D calculation? Yes?
We've done 2D now.
2D with one electron out.
No, we're done.
Two electrons out.
Is everybody with two electrons.
Okay.
Even 20 years.
Even 20? For molecules.
Atoms.
Okay. We are talking about molecules, actually. Okay. So so that's one reason that we wanted to get some understanding of what is going on for systems that are difficult to address. But the main reason for me is the underlying physics, so that the classical physics, as I'll show you, hopefully, can give you a picture that very rarely quantum mechanics can. So, of course, they are complementary. Let me not be misunderstood. because we are also doing completely quantum things in my group. But what classical physics can offer is a physical picture, can offer a model for what is going on. So again, what we do is a sophisticated version of the three-step model. And the challenges in classical treatments are, first of all, you must have a very accurate initial state. So that's a challenge to do that. It's an approximation you have to do, and you have to be clever about doing it properly. Also, another challenge for us is that we have to treat accurately the Coulomb singularity. So classically, of course, an electron can drop into the nucleus, so you have to deal with that. And we do deal with that when we don't just ignore it. Okay, and so here, for instance, let me say, you can see this is actually what you get for a diatomic molecule. I think it was a late 1980s paper by Olson, where he discusses how you can get the classical distribution for a diatomic molecule. And so here you can see the probability density in position along the internuclear distance. So you have your two nuclei. You are plotting the probability density along that axis. The classical microcanonical distribution is the solid line, while the quantum mechanical one is the dotted line. So you can see the agreement and the differences. And this is the probability density for momentum, for the magnitude of the momentum. So you can see it plotted here. And again, the solid line is the classical result, and the dotted line is the quantum mechanical. So you can see that it is a pretty good initial and accurate initial state. Okay, so let me start then with our initial state for molecules. So how do we go about it? Let me do a small review. Let me say something about it. So first of all, we have to calculate the exit point, right? So we have this is a picture for a diatomic molecule. We do similar things now for triatomic molecules. So this is our diatomic molecule, and it can tunnel. So we have to calculate this exit point. Now, for atomic systems, for one electron atoms, you can do it accurately, and well, no, but Landau and Lipschitz, you can do it in parabolic coordinates, and that's actually part of what they advertise in the TIPIS model, but this is actually what we have been doing, me included, and actually Chen and many other Chinese, starting in 1999 with the Physics Letters A paper, where they explicitly discuss in the context of strong field physics how you use parabolic coordinates to calculate the exit point. So this is what I have also been doing for the atomic systems. Of course, the story is much different when you have more than one electron and when you have molecules. So there, at least to my knowledge, you cannot do it exactly in parabolic coordinates, except if you satisfy some limits of your fields. But generally, we don't have these limits. I mean, we consider a wide variety of intensities. And so this is what we do instead. So we make an approximation, and we say that the electron tunnels along the direction of the laser field. So that's our first approximation, but you can test how exact that is. You can plot your potential contour plot of your potential, and you can see the range of where your electron gets out, and that's what we do. And so we see that for the problems that we consider, this is a pretty good approximation. And then we say that the potential that the electron that tunnels feels is the potential due to the two nuclei. And also, of course, the potential due to its interaction with the laser field, as well as a screening repulsive potential from the electron that remains behind. And so here you can see the charge density because of the presence of the other electron. We set that equal to the first ionization energy, and that's how we basically numerically solve what is the distance where the first electron tunnels. Now, the next thing we do is that we have to find the tunneling rate. So what is the probability for this process to take place? For atoms, we were using the ADK formula. Here, for these particular problems, which are they are not polarized molecules, I emphasize that, it's important, we use the formula by Mare et al. This is Misa Ivanov's I think he was Misa Ivanov's student, so Misa Ivanov is in this paper over here. So we are using basically their formula, which is based on the bottom line is that your tunneling rate has two parts, one part which looks like an ADK kind of formula. with a prefactor, and this prefactor has to do with the Dyson molecular orbital. So the overlap of the wave function in the ground state, of the two electron wave function in the ground state, and then the overlap with the ionic molecule, so the one electron remaining behind. So that's one part of the tunneling formula, and then there is another part which is has to do with the geometry of the molecule that you are dealing with, and also the orbital that your electron is escaping from. Okay, now there is some criticism in the literature, and I would like to address that. There is a criticism. Oh, but you are putting this ad hoc. Yes, that is true. We are putting it ad hoc, and I have two answers for it. One is that, yes, we are doing it ad hoc, but this is something that we have excellent agreement with, as I have shown you, quantum ab initio calculations. And secondly, and very importantly, this is a very nice experiment by Robert Moshammer, who he communicated nicely to me before it was actually published, where they actually show for the first time that what people always assume to be true, they see it experimentally now, on argon, where they have tested basically the formula for the initial distribution of the velocity of the electron after tunneling, where I think it was again Olga Smirnova's and Denisa Ivanov's paper, where they have their distribution, the strength of the field, the ionization energy, P perpendicular square, and the factor here that has to do with the wave function in momentum space of the initial orbital where the electron is starting from. So Robert, you can read the paper, what they have done there for argon. They have shown that this is pretty well satisfied and is imprinted on the final perpendicular momentum that they get. So it's not such an ad hoc argument anymore, since, and they are doing many more experiments. They are preparing more experiments now for molecules to show that this is something that you can also see experimentally now.
Excuse me, yes. What is the polarization of the laser in those experiments?
I think it's linear. Okay.
And Moshammer measures electrons or ions?
What he finally measures, you mean? I do know that he's calculating the electrons, for sure. Now, I think it's a cold dreams, so he may be measuring everything at the same time, but definitely he's getting the electronic wave function at the end, the momentum. Where can I turn this off from here? Good. Okay, so. And the remaining electron for us, so the remaining electron is in a microcanonical distribution for a diatomic, which you can see here. This is a paper by Olson, late 1980s, where he describes how you can do it in elliptical coordinates. Okay, and that's the first part. That's the initial distribution for our two electrons, how we start our calculation with. Of course, it's much more complicated if you want to treat more than two electrons. Okay, so again, you have to come up with. And if you want to deal with more than two atoms as well, it's not trivial. But anyway, so that's our initial state for diatomics. And now the second thing that is important is how do you deal with the Coulomb singularity? Okay, that's the problem, which treatments actually in our that many treatments completely ignore. There are even papers which have the Coulomb singularity and completely, you know, ignore the fact that you have to deal with it somehow. It's not like I can do okay, so I can propagate with Runge-Kunda and I'm happy. You shouldn't be happy because your electron can drop into the nucleus. And so you have to deal with that. And so that's exactly what we are doing. And we deal in, for atoms, it was a completely different story. There you can deal with regularized coordinates, and we can do it an analytical, basically, transformation. And then, of course, we solve numerically. Here it's a different, we went a different way. So we have done this, let me say that we have done this in two different ways. That was a paper that I'll show you later on, Rapid Communication PRA 2012, where I have done it using regularized coordinates, but for molecules, which is much more challenging because you have more than one center that you have to regularize at the same time. And then with my student Hugh Price, we did it in a completely different way, which is much more robust numerically. The two techniques give the same results, I should emphasize that. But we are going on now with this new technique because exactly numerically it's faster and more robust as far as also checking the errors that we have during the propagation. And so let me briefly say what we do. Yes.
How do you get the electron pill dropping into the
universe? So I'll tell you. So the first thing that we do is a global regularization in scheme of Hege in 1974, which you see over here. And so basically we transform to the relative coordinates, and we find, of course, the corresponding momentum for these new space coordinates. And effectively, we have n minus 1 over 2 fictitious particles, which are the relative coordinates and their conjugate and their momentum. And so here is the set once you do this transformation, which is very well described in this paper. And by the way, so it's very, it was very funny for me because I people are addressing these issues for years now in celestial mechanics. Somehow we don't in strong field physics. But anyway, so these are all papers on celestial mechanics, all the papers that you see cited for these techniques. And so anyway, so what we are doing basically, we are implementing them in strong field physics. So the difference from them is that we have also a strong field. And so here are the equations of motion that we end up with. And now...
Can I just add? I mean,
yes.
Because I'm not familiar with this. This is because you have two electrons, and one of them carries away all the energy, and the other one can get infinitely fouled. Is that what you mean? Or?
So what I mean is that you have the electron, right?
Yeah.
And you have the nuclei.
Yeah. Because if you only have one electron and one nuclei, I mean, the electron
The electron can come very close to the nucleus. So if it is like an impact problem also. Okay, so the electron can come very close to the nucleus. There is nothing forbidding it from coming very close. While quantum mechanically you have a zero energy, that does not allow you to drop to the nucleus. You cannot come infinitely close to the nucleus quantum mechanically, but you can classically. So it's like a binary problem. I mean, you have a collision, a binary collision. Is there anything in the Coulomb potential? It's a 1 over R. Potential. Is there anything preventing the electron which is attracted to the nucleus coming very close? No. There's nothing. Right? If you leave an electron there, it will fall and doesn't have initial energy, it will fall to the nucleus, correct?
For S electrons.
What do you mean for S electrons?
If the angle is zero, it will fall, but if it has finite angle,
of course, the motion is complicated. Of course, it depends on all that stuff. But I'm saying, in principle, is there something that is forbidding your electron, forget the angular or whatever? Naively speaking, I mean, you have an impact problem, and you have your electron. Can it come very close to the nucleus?
Yes.
It can. And so that's the issue. But that's the issue for us.
Okay. But it can have very, very high energy.
Exactly. Yeah. And so numerically, you're completely, your errors are immense there.
You need to go to relativistic mechanics.
Before we go to relativistic mechanics, of course, if your field is so strong that doesn't field, of course, that's what you're saying, the nucleus, then we are good, thank you. But then in that sense, we can do also strong field approximation, but that's not what we want to do, right? Yes.
Well, in many calculations using classical mechanics, I mean the earlier calculations by Percival and others, the case L equals zero was avoided by adding 1/2, which is the longer prescription for going from classical to quantum mechanics.
No, but actually, Alfred,
And so, is it completely wrong or what?
No, actually, Percival is the first guy who did who described how to do the initial state.
Yes, to model an S state.
Yes.
Hydrogen.
So how do you model?
Take an angular momentum of 1/2.
Okay, I don't know exactly what he has done, but let me ask you this: how do you deal with the fact that you have a field, okay, and the field can bring your electron back to the nucleus? I mean, I clearly showed you, right?
No, I agree. But
so,
if the electron gains some angular momentum, it doesn't go back.
So if it does. Happy for the electron and for the rest of us, and we don't have to deal with it. But how do you know? How do you know that? So it's a general, I'm trying to do it in the most general way. Let me make it clear, okay? So people have been doing also things without taking into account the Kulob singularity. You have soft core potentials, okay? And of course you can get very nice results, qualitative results, okay, to predict phenomena that nobody has predicted before. So let me make this clear. But me, I'm also talking, my intention is not only to gain an understanding, but also to touch base with calculations out there and say that mine are numerically also accurate. So to guarantee that, okay, if there are some conditions are satisfied, then maybe the electron doesn't drop in the nucleus. But generally speaking, there's, why shouldn't it? And actually we see it, by the way. We know that it happens. We know that it can happen. Okay, and let me actually make it actually much more clear. I think that's a better answer. So I'll answer you in a different way. We are talking about strong field physics. How about, which is where I started from, single photon stuff. In single photon stuff, it is the Kulob singularity, okay, from Wagner's law. Actually, that's my first, what I started with, okay, with Jan-Michael. So it is the Kulob singularity, it's the Wagner's law that says that it is proportional, the cross-section, to the energy to a beta factor. And this beta factor, you actually get completely from non-linear analysis of the Kulob singularity. This beta, that actually Jan-Michael has shown, this is actually a ratio of Lyapunov exponents of this strange fixed point, the Kulob singularity, which is the Lyapunov exponents of the angular degrees of freedom, the angular modes for the fixed point, let's, I don't know how to call them, let's say theta, over the Lyapunov exponent that corresponds to the radial part of the fixed point. So here the dynamics in single photon is completely determined by this Kulob singularity. Okay. This is double, triple, whatever ionization, it's true. Okay, so we have done it for, I have done it for double, I have done it for triple, I have done it for quadruple. The quadruple actually was a paper that we published with my student in 2013. So that's a case for you where it is absolutely sensitive. If you put a soft core potential here, you're doomed. You will get completely wrong results here. Okay, but of course in a strong field, okay, it's more forgiving. Of course, because it's a strong field, so it's interacting now strongly with the electric field as well. Okay, so this is the first thing that we do. Okay, so we transform to a system with relative coordinates, and these are the equations of motion that we get. And then what we do to answer your question, Tony, for this particular case, we introduce also a time transformation. And this time transformation now depends on the relative distances of all particles involved. So in our case, if we have a diatomic, we have four particles involved. And this is proportional, it's a sum over all distances of one over the distance between the electrons and the nuclei, or electron-electrons, or nuclei-nuclei. So whenever one of them becomes very small, this is fully accounted for here. So if a distance becomes very small, that effectively means that our calculation takes, it is an adaptive step, and so it takes very, very small steps so that it actually accounts for it as accurately as possible, while it has also the advantage that when the distances are very large between the particles, then we don't worry about it, and so we can go with very large steps. So it's a very efficient transformation, because when it is very small, it detects it, it takes very small steps so that it is accurate, and when it is very large, it takes, the distances are very large, the time step also can be very large, and we are good, we are fast in our calculation. And so what we are also doing besides this time transformation is now we are basically, the numerical technique is a leapfrog technique, so that's the propagation step, where we have two sets. That's actually, you can see in the paper here, it's discussed very nicely. And so what we have in our case, we have adapted it to our case, and so we have two sets of variables. We have the position and time, we have the momenta, and the W we didn't write here, but W is equal omega, basically, here. And so we are solving in half a step, so the leapfrog technique. We take half a step, h over 2, and we solve for time and position. And then using these values, we take a full step in momentum and w, h. And then we take finally a full step in the position and time using the values of the momentum and w in half the step. And finally, we incorporate this leapfrog technique in a very, very nice technique that I cannot pronounce this. I will kill it, but I'll say it. Okay, bullet stir method, where the idea is basically that you have a step, you split your step in sub-steps, and basically you vary the number. In each sub-step, you use the leapfrog technique, and you vary the number of sub-steps until your calculation converges, which means, in the case of bullet stir method, that it has done a successful extrapolation to the limit that h goes to zero, so that this little step here goes to zero. When it has achieved that numerically, it stops. And so that is our technique, and that's how we are actually, yes?
In the last equations, had q0, t0, or qf, tf that you plug in?
I didn't understand the question. So q1, is a full step at h.
Okay, but
so
it's half, still h over 2?
Yes, it's still h over 2 here. It's h over 2 because it has taken half a step at the beginning. It takes for q and t, it takes full step in the momentum and w.
Yeah.
And then it takes another half step in q and t using the values of w and rho at the full step.
Okay, so in this case, it should not be q0, q half instead of q0.
It can be, but I'm not 100%. No, this is for sure correct. Now, this it can be not, but you can easily check. I mean, we have our paper, it's on the Los Alamos archive. Okay, it can be that it's a typo. I cannot see it right now, but it can be. Okay, but the bottom line is that you take half a step here, full step, half a step in the next one. Okay. Okay, and so that is, of course, I consider that a big advantage of our calculations, that they are numerically, for classical calculations, I claim that they are as accurate as they can be, because we fully account for the Coulomb singularity in the propagation, and we fully account for nuclear and electronic motion at every time. Of course, you can argue how good your initial state is. That's a different story. But as far as propagation is concerned, we fully treat the Coulomb singularity. Now, there is another challenge, actually, which I should have said later. It will make sense to you later on, and I will point that out. So you would think, okay, I have done all these things, I'm good. No, you're not. So the first time that I tried to do that for a diatomic molecule, that was 2.5 years ago, I think, and my guide there was Andres' paper on enhanced ionization. I was doing it, I was not getting the, fully classically, in the propagation fully classically, because the first step is semi-classical, but we were not getting enhanced ionization. It was minimal. And so then I realized that it's not enough to have the semi-classical step at the beginning. Your semi-classical step should also be at all times during your propagation. And so that's actually something. Well, for molecules, it's the first time that anyone has done that, from what I have seen, and it is actually a big deal. And I'll explain why. If you don't do it, you cannot get enhanced ionization or anything like that. Now, where did I see it for the first time? Okay, so that we give credit to the people that we should give credit to. Cohen in 2000, it was a one-electron atom in a laser field, and actually also, which I didn't know, Burgdorfer has done it a couple of times in a couple of his papers in the papers that he's doing half-cycle pulses, if I'm not mistaken. I cannot remember, but it's definitely also in Joachim's Burgdorfer work that I have seen it. So we are also implementing it at all times during our propagation. In other words, what we are doing is, at every step in our propagation, we are checking whether the electron is reaching a classical turning point. Has it reached a classical turning point? Then what we do, we use, this is the WKB formula for tunneling. We calculate it, and basically we create, so it's like rolling a dice. And we are creating a random number between 0 and 1. We calculate the tunneling probability, and we say if this tunneling probability is greater than the random number we have generated, it has tunneled, otherwise it has not. So that's what we do, and this is a very important step, otherwise you will get nothing, let me tell you that. And also now another very nice thing that my student Hugh Price, who just graduated, has done, is to formulate very transparently the way that we actually calculate probability densities. And after that, I'll actually go ahead and tell you the results. But that I consider very important, and I'll explain why. Because in the papers that they were so far out, this was not what they were doing. So how are we calculating now the probability? So what we are doing is the following. So we have, this is the pulse. Okay, and so what we are doing is that we are random, you can select randomly the phase when your system, when the propagation is initiated. So the electron can tunnel, okay, which I have repeatedly said, I mean many times people assume that it tunnels at the top of the, at the highest value of the field. We don't assume that. We don't assume anything in this case, except our initial state. So here we are basically accounting for all possibilities, for the electron to tunnel at any given point in the laser pulse. And so you select randomly, you can select randomly this phase, and then what do? You calculate, you propagate your trajectory. And let's say I'm interested in double ionization. So if my trajectory double, if I have electrons which double ionize, I say register this phase, calculate the tunneling rate at this phase, and that's how you start adding up your probabilities. Okay? That's what actually, I cannot remember their name, I should, but Chen is one of the authors, in a 2008 and 2009 or 10. A PRL and PRA paper, that's how they are doing it. But this is very dangerous. I have done it also in 2012, but I realized that this is very dangerous and actually not so accurate. And I'll explain why. Okay, so what we have done, we are doing it differently now, and I'll explain the difference. Now, or maybe I should say first why it is kind of dangerous. Because it can, if you are below the barrier, you are good. As soon as you go above the barrier, now you have two different regimes. You have the below the barrier, the above the barrier, and the microcanonical distributions are completely different in both cases. So you have completely different normalization constants that you have to account to. If you don't account for the difference properly, you get wrong results. Okay. But now we are doing something else, which is much more transparent, and I'll show you why it is much more transparent. So now what we are doing is that we go to each phase, so we bin the phase, and we create initial condition for each phase, and then we propagate these trajectories with these phases, and we register those phi zeros that give us the event that we want. And that's what this P phi zero process means. So this is the probability for a given phase phi zero to get the events that I want, either double ionization, enhanced ionization, frustrated ionization, whatever it is. You multiply by the tunneling rate at that phase, and then you sum over, you normalize, so you sum over all the phases you have created and the tunneling rate that corresponds to this phase phi zero. Now, why is this more transparent? You can see why it is over here. Okay, so here now we are plotting the probability for a certain event, in this case actually it's double ionization, as a function of phi zero. And the blue line is an intensity just below the barrier, which is 2.03 in this case. The green line is just above the barrier, and the red line is just above the red barrier. So this is 2.03 below, 2.13 above. Now, what is the difference between these two? This is a double microcanonical distribution, which is what our Chinese colleagues have been doing in the 2008 and a series of papers on molecules. And this is what I have also done in 2012. But see how wrong it looks. It's not continuous. When you go from below the barrier to above, just above the barrier, it drops completely down. While if we do something else, and that's what we are doing actually, and this, we are not the first one to mention this. I have seen it in a paper. Oh, God, what's her name? In Jena. She just became a faculty there. Does anybody remember?
Taurus.
Who?
Taurus.
No, no, not Paulus. This is Young. She was working. Who? No, she was working with Burgdorfer. It's a woman. God, I cannot remember. It's a PRA paper. It came out in 2013. Agri Stout is also co-author. I can't remember. Anyway, so I mean, the funny thing is that we did it independently, and then because I collaborate with Andre told me, Rapid, you know, there's this paper also out. Although they don't take a position there, which one is the most accurate one, I take a position and I say that this is way more accurate. And so what we are doing now, instead of a double microcanonical, which you can see that is completely discontinuous compared to just below the barrier, this one is also, of course, not ideal, but it is better. So what we are doing now is that we are doing something similar as we are doing for below the barrier. So again, we allow our electron to tunnel, even though it doesn't tunnel because it's over the barrier. And so we put it at the top of the potential well, and we give it a velocity which is equal, the kinetic energy, which is equal with the difference between the potential, the ionization potential, which is now, of course, above the barrier, minus the energy at the top of the barrier. Okay. So anyway, so formulate, it's just a little thing, it's just a different formulation, but it's not so little, because it means that conceptually you understand better what's going on. And also, I hope it's a motivation for people who spend time discussing what the your initial distribution should be past when it exits, when it gets out. It's a motivation for people to get better distributions, because clearly you have an issue here. It's something that the transition from the tunneling to the over the barrier regime needs to be addressed. Okay, so I have covered hopefully whatever I thought it was important for our calculation. And so now let me show you our results on diatomics first. And so again, I don't need to tell you that this is a complicated problem because you have many processes taking place. So you have Coulomb explosion of the nuclei, you have ionization. And so actually it was a very good time when Uli Eichmann came to me and he said, Agapi, we have this experiment 2009, 2008, they have published the frustrated ionization. That's what I'll be talking about for the rest of this talk. Frustrated ionization for atoms. And in 2009, they have done the experiment for molecules. So they wanted a theoretical calculation, and to my knowledge, nobody could do it because it was two electrons and full fragmentation at the same time. And it was a good time because I was also doing it anyway, and so we collaborated with Uli, and it was a very successful collaboration. And that was my first work on diatomics with moving nuclei. And so here you can see the experimental result, and the process that we are describing is H2 strongly driven, and what happens is at the end you have a certain probability to create highly excited electrons, so you create the Rydberg states. That's what the H star stands for. You have H plus ion, and you have your electron that is escaping. And so they wanted to understand how these atoms, these Rydberg atoms, are created. Okay, that was the question. And so you can see the experimental result here. It's a double differential where we have, this is the energy of the Rydberg atom, and this is the energy of the ion. And you can see they have two different parts. This I cannot account for in my calculation. Okay, so let me make clear. I'm not claiming that we can cover everything with this calculation. We can't. But I claim that the things that we can cover them very accurately.
So what
could be the C is the Coulomb explosion. This is a bond softening. I cannot account. Bond softening. Okay. Okay, so for that, I shouldn't say I cannot account, but I should say, as the program stands right now, my code stands right now, I can't. But we have not addressed it. Okay, so that I'm clear. I don't want to say it cannot be done, but right now, as the code stands, we are not addressing it. Okay, this is Coulomb explosion. That's exactly what we can fully account for. And so that's his result, and that's our result, and there was very, very good agreement. And so, as I promised, I'm finally getting there. That's why I do, half of my group is doing classical physics, because you can understand what's going on. And so in their paper in 2009, Uli Eichmann and Alejandro was also a co-author in that paper, I think, they have conjectured that how does this happen? It happens through a frustrated kind of ionization. What does this mean? You have your two nuclei, and okay, one electron is out completely, gets out, and that's it. doesn't come back. Now, of course, the two nuclei start exploding, and they reach a distance, which is, we know, among other people from Andra, that is the distance, the ideal distance for enhanced ionization. So ionization is enhanced. Why? And I have a picture later on. So this is the picture that you normally see. So your electron now is sitting somewhere here, and now it can tunnel easily through the intermediate potential, and then it's out. Okay, and so they said, okay, so one electron is gone, and then I have the remaining electron, my nuclei are fragmenting. They reach this distance, so now the remaining bound electron gains energy. But it is not enough to ionize it, but it is enough for it to tunnel. Okay, and so it tunnels, and that's why they call it frustrated tunnel ionization. So it tunnels, and that's how these fragments are created. And that's half the story. So we have done the calculation, and that's, so here is what you see. This is what I call pathway A, and this is basically our first electron. This is the electron in our calculation that tunnels in the initially at time zero. So with this semi-classical first step with the tunneling formula, it's out, goes out, doesn't come back, and then the other electron after a certain distance basically gains energy from the field, tunnel ionizes, you can see it here, now it has tunnel, it oscillates in the field, and then, I take this back, no, here it is still oscillating in the atom, now it tunnels and it is bound in a Rydberg state. Okay, but that's half the story. So half our events are doing that. Then there is another part to the story, and that is correlation, electron-electron correlation. So it turns out that this is not the only thing. Actually, this step can be much bigger than this one. And so what happens is that the first electron tunnels, but now comes back, gives energy to the remaining electron. This remaining electron now completely takes off, ionizes, and it is the initial electron that tunneled that comes back and remains behind. So the initially bound electron now becomes completely ionized, while the other one has given part of its energy to the bound electron and remains behind. So that's step path, what we call pathway B. They are two different stories here. In one case, so here you see the momentum in the field is linear. It is along the z-axis, and this is the one of the perpendicular directions, and this is the momentum of the ionized electron, which in this case is what I call electron 1. And in this case, the ionized electron is electron 2, the initially bound electron, and you see it over here. Okay, so you can see that the momentum is very different, and that makes sense, because this bound electron that finally ionizes interacts with the nucleus much more. And that's why the momentum is much more spread out. Okay, and so that's exactly what I've just said, is that you can see that this is pathway A, where the momentum in the perpendicular direction is more confined, while here in pathway B, the momentum in the perpendicular direction extends in a larger values of the momentum. Okay, and so of course we can test all these things. I mean, as an interpretation, and so we're saying, how does frustrated ionization happen? It happens through frustrated enhanced ionization, because this picture we can test in our calculation. That's the big advantage, again, of classical calculations. So we can check the distance of the nuclei. The distance of the nuclei when the electron tunnels. We can check that in our calculation. And we find that this, here it is, this is the distribution of the distance of the nuclei when the bound electron in pathway A tunnels. And what do we find? That this happens around 4.5 to 5 atomic units internuclear distance, which again we know from Andre that this is the distance when enhanced ionization takes place. Also, in our calculation, of course, we can calculate here it's the energy of the fragment, so the energy of H plus or EH star, and this is the energy of the H plus fragments for double ionization, which is enhanced, mostly enhanced ionization, and this is for frustrated tunnel ionization, and you can see that they are almost the same. So that's one indication that indeed this formation takes place through a frustrated enhanced ionization process. But then we also saw that there is correlation. And so, okay, but what kind of correlation? Can we quantify this or qualitatively discuss it a little bit? Yes.
May I ask one thing for clarity in my head?
Yeah, yeah.
Why are you using the adjective frustrated with respect to what is this process?
Ah, okay, it was not my term. I can tell you why I think they call it like that. So it was the terminology was given in the 2008-2009 paper, and everybody's using it. So I'm sticking with it so that people understand what on earth I'm talking about. But so it's not my term, so that I make this clear. Now, they call it, but it does make sense, because it's frustrated with respect to double ionization. Okay, so it's frustrated, if I understand correctly. Okay, so you have two electrons in an atom, let's say. In an atom, you have two electrons. In frustrated ionization, one electron is out, and the other is in a Rydberg state. So it's frustrated because it wanted to go out as well. Double ionization, but it didn't. It stayed behind. So they call it, that's why we also call it in our way, frustrated double ionization. So don't ask me, I don't know how they came up with this term.
It's enhanced single ionization, but frustrated.
It's a frustrated enhanced ionization. Enhanced ionization in this case, I'm referring to two electrons always. One electron is immediately out, right?
But it's
right?
One stays.
Exactly.
It's and the second one. Single ionization, but frustrated.
The second one stays stuck in a Rydberg state.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. So it's frustrated because it didn't get out.
Sandler, I think, invented
that. Who invented that?
Sandler.
Ah, Sandler. Okay, so it's not my terminology. I'm just giving you my interpretation of it.
But yeah. In the strong field context,
yes,
the re-scattering mechanism is the major mechanism for double ionization at infrared.
Clearly not, right, for enhanced ionization.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, so it's not re-scattering.
No, I'm not talking about scattering. Enhanced ionization is the standard nature. So.
Wait, now I'm confused. What do you mean the standard? What means the standard?
I mean how double ionization occurs.
Yeah. For molecules.
Yeah,
for molecules.
Yeah. This standard picture is the
enhanced ionization.
Standard.
Yes.
To explain,
Andre explained. 20 years ago.
Yeah, so yes. That's what I call it. That's what I mean by standard picture. Now, it is not frustrated with respect to that. Some weak field excitation in Rydberg state as a standard, it may be frustrated.
No, I didn't understand this. Because what I understand is this is the picture. This is enhanced ionization. You can have double ionization there. Now, they find, which people, I don't know, but they didn't know before, you have 10% of events. This is a very big process. I didn't say this. I should have emphasized it from the beginning. This process is bigger than rescattering here. Should have emphasized, this is a very important process. So, and I'll...
What is the very important process?
The frustrate, enhanced is very important. But it also depends on the field intensity that you are at.
Of course.
So enhanced becomes important, let's say, for... we are doing a triatomic, so it is in my mind right now. I can give you an example. Triatomic, if you have a H3+, and you're doing enhanced at 0.02 atomic units, you will see nothing. There's nothing there. It's minimal. But not frustrated. So I don't know what you mean. Okay, so what I'm trying to say is this frustrated to me is frustrated because you have double ionization in enhanced ionization. Of course, you can have one electron. That's how Andre did it 20 years ago. But you can also have two. One gets out, and then one remains behind and gains energy at this distance, can tunnel, get out. In this case, it tunnels but doesn't get out. And in that sense, we call it frustrated. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. We have to ask who actually.
It's also been discovered in H3+ by the people at Kansas State now.
They did that, but after Uli, right? They did that in 2000. They have a series of papers, I know. In 2011, 2012, yes. So they have seen that for a triatomic. And there are also papers also with soft core potentials on triatomics. That, of course, I know that. But, let me say the but.
You like the word but.
I like the word but, yes, because I tell you why. Because they claim, it's a nice word, but they claim, oh, we can do everything. Yes, you can do everything. But when it comes to frustrated tunnel ionization, they cannot show tunneling. And this thing, so they cannot distinguish between tunneling all over the barrier. So that I consider a big disadvantage, okay, for this process which happens through tunneling mainly. Okay, so now the second question, so the other thing for us was, okay, so there is, it's frustrated tunnel enhanced ionization, but we also saw that there is a pathway where there is correlation. What correlation is this? And, okay, not that this answers the question what correlation it is, but it gives you a picture again. Okay, so in the rescattering model, so now we go to the rescattering model, which, by the way, roughly we can distinguish in our calculations which are rescattering events and which are enhanced ionization events, roughly, and this is not more than 4%. Frustrated ionization is 10% here, so it's a very important process. So in rescattering, when the electron comes back, from atoms we know many years. Now two things can happen, and people still discuss it. You can have the electron giving energy immediately to the other electron, so you have both of them ionized, and they get out with large momenta. So everybody calls it something else. I call it direct ionization. And there are other people, and there's another mechanism where the electron comes back, gives a little bit of energy to the other electron, but not enough. So this first one goes out after recollision, but this one stays behind and ionizes later on. So it ionizes with a delay. That's what people, many people refer to as resi. I call it delayed ionization. So here is the rescattering, the direct ionization, so large momenta for both electrons, which ionize at the same time. And this is the momenta of the electrons when there is delayed. And so from this picture, roughly we can say, okay, the correlation in frustrated ionization definitely doesn't look like this. It looks much more like this. So it is a weak correlation and not a strong one as in direct ionization. And so another thing that we did, you can see it both ways. You can see that you can control the pathways, or you can see it that it is another verification that there are two pathways which are a consistency test for us, basically. So we applied elliptical fields now. Okay, so this was with a linear field. Tony, how much, what time is it? So that I know what's going on.
It's 11.
11, okay, so I'll finish, if I finish in 10 minutes, is okay? If not, tell me, so you come, 5 minutes is okay? Okay. All right, so we apply also elliptical fields here. Okay, and so we basically plot, this is the probability, this is pathway A, so the one where there is no correlation, and this is where there is correlation. And we plot the probability as a function of the ellipticity, where here it is the ellipticity. Notice that our field strength is not constant as we vary the ellipticity. I say that because different people do different things, okay? It doesn't matter for us, really. I mean, we could have done it one way or the other, but okay. But the results, of course, would have been a little bit different. So what you see here is that pathway B drops much faster with ellipticity, which is another confirmation that there is correlation, because we do know, many years now people have discussed this, that if you have an elliptical field, then recollision is much more rare, okay? Because it offsets the returning electron, it doesn't come back really to the core, and so it cannot interact with the other electrons, so much as it does, of course, in linear ellipticity. I'm not saying that there's no recollision at all, so that I make myself clear. Okay, so it goes down much faster. These are two different intensities. This is below the barrier, over the barrier for the diatomic, while the other one, the other one also goes down, but goes down less. And briefly, okay, it's kind of clear why it does go down even for both pathways. I mean, this is the change in momentum from the time tunneling during propagation, not that tunneling at the beginning, so the when the electron tunnels and remains bound in a Rydberg state. So this is the change in momentum between that time and at the end of the pulse, assuming that tunneling takes place again during the propagation at the maximum of the field. This is more or less the change in momentum, so that you can see that the higher the ellipticity, of course, the higher the change in momentum, and so you have more double ionization events than frustrated ionization. And so, yeah, okay, I don't want to say much here. I want to move on and finish with the triatomic. Basically, here, it's another way of saying pretty much the same thing, that here at the zero ellipticity, we have the pathway B, which is the broad background, pathway A, while as you move on, actually maybe this is important for one reason, as you move to a higher ellipticity, we have two lobes. Now note again that we can reproduce another result very accurately here. It's known from atoms and a couple only, to my knowledge, calculations on and an experiment on H2, that there is an asymmetry with ellipticity in the lobes. Okay, and that was actually predicted in 1988 in atoms, if I'm not mistaken. There is an asymmetry, and this is due to Coulomb asymmetry, so that we can also reproduce very accurately. That's another check for us with elliptical pulses. Another thing that we can check is, of course, where does tunneling take place from? Upfield, lobe field, so all these things we can check. And that's what we have done, and so what I can tell you is that for intensities in the tunneling regime, 85%, we see that the electron tunnels from an upfield, as is the usual picture for enhanced ionization. But 15% is definitely, we find at least low field and single well. As you increase the intensity, this goes down. And so we have more contribution from single wells and low fields. That's at least what we find. Still, it's the dominant process. And I'll finish with this. So we have now many more results, but since we are in the process of getting things together, I'll just give you a taste of what these techniques can do. And so now that's of high interest to me, triatomics. And so here we have H3+, so we have three atoms, we have three nuclei, two electrons, and so again, one of the things that we are checking right now is frustrated tunnel ionization. I shouldn't really be telling tunneling, but anyway, frustrated ionization. And again, you see that this is a very significant process. It's 9% altogether. Okay. And this is for an, I think it's 0.08 atomic unit. So here we have high fields, really, for H3+. And here what you see is the probability of the energy distribution, basically, of the fragments. This is H+, E star. Now, you see that it peaks around 9 eV, but this is not consistent, although it was consistent for the diatomic, this is not consistent with your atom breaking up. So for the diatomic, we said, okay, we check our results constantly. I mean, and so for the double ionization case for the diatomic, we check if the distribution of the distances that we get for the tunneling time, okay, so we find 5 atomic units for the diatomic, as I mentioned, which is also what Andre has seen for diatomics many years ago. So 5 atomic units that immediately can give you the energy of the fragments at the end. So that's what we should find in the energy distribution. That's what we do find for the diatomic. Not here, though. Okay, so here again, we can check what the distance is. We find that pretty much is the same. It doesn't change. 5 atomic units again. So it should be a maximum of 5 eV. But that's not the case. We see that the maximum is 9 eV. So why is that? Is there something wrong? No. What is happening is, so what we did to check what on earth was going on here, is we checked what was the energy of the fragments at of EH+, but they are not fragments yet, of the nuclei at the time that one of the electron tunnels. And so we see that at that time, although for if I was to plot it for H2, you would have seen that it was peaking at 0. Here it's peaking at a 3 to 4 electronvolt. Now, why? Why is it? So basically, for the triatomic, the nuclei are much faster at the time of tunneling. Does this make sense or not? It does, because you have one electron which is screening 3 nuclei now. Before you had one electron which was screening 2 nuclei. So they are much faster. And I'll finish with that. That's what we have been doing this in this last couple of years on even more than that, on diatomics and triatomics. And that's the story.
You mentioned that in propagating out an electron, you found it important in the molecular problem to treat tunneling during your propagation.
Yes, yes.
If I understand things properly, if you had one electron system, that wouldn't be necessary.
It would be.
It would
Absolutely.
Because classically, you mean you're ionizing or not. I mean, in quantum mechanics, you can ionize a part in the ground state.
What does it mean you ionize or not? What does it mean classically? So in my case, so this is what I'm talking about. So we have, actually, this tunneling thing, if you check, I can give you the reference, Cohen 2000, that's exactly what he's doing for one electron. Burgdorfer the same, for one electron. Burgdorfer and Cohen, I can give you the references, okay? By the way, I don't know, I mean, I don't know if I have said, all this stuff is on the Los Alamos archive. Okay, did I have that there? It is posted since June, so you can see all the references to these things. Yes, here it is. So there we have all the references. I don't have the Burgdorfer reference, but I can find it for you. But I have the Cohen reference. And so, no, it has nothing to do with the fact that they are two electrons. It has to do with the okay, this is what I'm talking about. Okay, so my electron is somewhere here, let's say, okay, and I propagate. And the field is changing. And some time later, it can be that it's doing something like this. So now my electron hits this point. And I check. It hits this point. What does that mean? For me, it means, not for me, that's what it means, that's what we're doing numerically. It means that in a time step, it has a velocity which goes this way. And in the next time step, it has a velocity which goes that way. Okay? That's what it means. It also means that we check the energy of the electron at that time, okay, and we see that it is bound, that is below the barrier. Okay, so of course, if I was to do the calculation completely classically, I would say, oh, nothing happens, this thing goes back and forth and back and forth, it does nothing. Okay, but what I'm saying is that if I was to do this, then you cannot describe anything properly. When you have fragmentation, that is. When there is fragmentation and there is enhanced ionization. When enhanced ionization plays a role, if you just do this and you don't account for tunneling, your results are completely wrong. I mean completely wrong, not just by... So enhanced ionization is like 50% and you get a 1%. That's what I'm talking about. Okay, and so what we do is the following. We say, at every single step, we check along the direction of the field. That's an approximation again, of course. But that is the same approximation that we did at the beginning for the exit point. We check and we say, does the velocity reverse sign? Let's say if it doesn't, then we're good. We just go on about our lives. If it does, you calculate the energy at this point. And then what you do is you calculate with WKB approximation, the tunneling probability through the tunneling. So we calculate the action. It's the energy of my electron at this time minus the potential that it feels along, this R is along the direction of the field. Okay, along the direction of the field, and we integrate along the direction of the field from this point, A, let's call it, to B. We calculate these points in our calculation, and we say from integral from A to B. So we calculate our action, and we put it in our exponential. What does it mean? Minus 2, I think, this integral. And that's it. That is actually an approximation, I should say. This is the WKB in the limit that the barrier is... what is it? Very deep, I think. Yes.
There's no tunneling time.
But that's okay. Since you're breaking it up, yeah. Yeah, yeah, of course. Okay. Which actually, so the Cohen, you can definitely find it here. And I can easily find the Burgdorfer one because he cites Cohen all the time. Okay, so if we go on the web. No, no, no. Ah, I'm killing the name. Oh, no, no, no. Okay, okay. So it is Cohen. Cohen. Okay, sorry. Okay, Greek pronunciation. Okay, so it's a 2000 PRA paper. Okay, I have to find it, but it is also cited in there, specifically at the point where we discuss this tunneling. Okay, so that he did it first to my knowledge in the sense of strong field stuff, and then it was Burgdorfer. Am I killing his time? Yes, somehow. Yeah. Okay. Both offer, I killed it, but okay, you get your hit. So he did it, I can't remember, 2006, 2007, some around that time. For this one, I'm sure. This one I remember less, but you can easily find that as well. If you go to the Web of Science and see who is citing Cochin, you will find Book Doctor. Okay.
Okay, let me start here.
I've got a question, similar things. So it seems what you're doing, I'm trying to get a feel for the method, it seems like a deterministic random walk, in a sense, because it seems that, so the electron moves on a classic trajectory.
Yes.
That's correct. And then when it hits the
wall,
so to speak, there's a certain funding called the
Yes.
So basically you've got sections of classical trajectories
and sections of semi-classical
and like the turning points you get
a tunneling probability. Yes.
So how crucial is the fact that the trajectories are classical? Quint, I could think of it, or make it even simpler. I think of this as a kind of a box and just have like straight line trajectories and when it hits the wall, there's the tunneling probability you're using. So.
So what are you asking me? I didn't understand the question.
How crucial is it that you...
That I include this step? It's absolutely crucial.
Now, like, how important is it that you solve for the motion for the classical trajectories in the Coulomb potential? I could, you know, just think of straight lines going in between, like a billiard.
Do you mean how sensitive it is to the actual Coulomb potential? Is that what you're asking me? Of course it is very sensitive. It's very sensitive.
I mean, for instance,
I cannot give you an example here, but I can give you an example from the atom, my story in the atoms, right? I mean, come on. Yeah, here, right? This is why you're getting this, because it's interacting with the nucleus.
I think what I'm saying is, can you replace the full Coulomb dynamics by a Coulomb billiard with a tunneling?
But why would I do that? Because then you have an approximation, complete approximation. But it's okay. People are doing simpler things, but I don't want to do this. I want to do something which gives me a picture, but is accurately numerically.
Thank you.
If I can add something, is that the advantage of the classical simulations is that you can take into account exactly the Coulomb potential.
That's a good point. While in
standard quantum mechanical calculations, the so-called strong field approximation uses plane waves to describe the motion of the electron within the laser field. Waves, or Volkov waves, if you want, but the idea is that you don't take into account the Coulomb effect. And it's a big there is a big discussion in quantum, for people doing quantum treatments, how to include the Coulomb potential properly in the calculation. So that's one of the advantages of the classical simulation.
And now that you say that, let me remember something for you. I have another answer for you besides this effect. So the fact, okay, so because I mentioned it, I was also pointing out that to Ursula Keller. So when we did calculations, my first diatomic calculations, no fragmentation, fixed nuclei, okay, and you do it for a higher field, okay, the electron doesn't tunnel at the top of the barrier, at the top of the field. People have this picture in their mind that always it's tunneling from there. No, it is tunneling way past it, and one of the reasons is the interaction with the Coulomb, its interaction with the Coulomb potential. If that was not there, it would be at the top of the field.
Of H2 plus with such a person. You thought that you include electron nuclear dynamics, but let's think about H2 plus. Your electrons becomes classical, the whole dynamics be classical. So there's no screening between protons. So Coulomb exposure will be overestimated.
I don't think that
your electron has gone. So there is no screening of cloud over.
That's why I said the partial is
too strong.
If it is too strong or not, I don't know. What I can tell you is, as I said, that I cannot do bond softening. I said that from the beginning, right? That was the reason.
Yeah.
Exactly, that what you're pointing out. But I said that as it stands right now, but let me, because this is important. We cannot do bone softening as it stands right now, but I'm not overestimating. Can I answer? So I'm answering, and I'm saying what I said from the beginning, that I cannot do bone softening. I said that. And that's exactly the reason why I can't. I said I can do Coulomb explosion. Whether I overestimate or not, I can only compare with the results that I have at hand. The results that I have at hand are Uli Eichmann's results on frustrated ionization. And we get, he gets a 10%, I get a 10%. That's all I can say. Whether, you know, of course, I'm not saying that 10% is the Bible, but for me, the fact that I'm plus, like, 50, even if I was 50% off from him, I would be happy in this case for such a calculation, because that's a very demanding calculation.
This semi-classical correction that you were introducing, at what level you are putting it, at the probability level, at the trajectory level, where are you putting it in this factor?
It's at the trajectory level. Trajectory level, while we are propagating, so there's nothing with the probability, it doesn't affect the weighting. Okay, so let me say how we do this. So we start our trajectory at initial position. Okay. And the weight there is only the tunneling rate. That's it. That's the only weight we are putting in. And we started, as I described, at the exit point, velocity zero, this I didn't say, but this is velocity zero in the direction parallel to the field, Gaussian distribution in the perpendicular, as it is usually done. And then we propagate classically. And at every step of our calculation, we check. Does it hit turning point? Does it hit a turning point? If it does, you do the following. You generate a random number between 0 and 1. You calculate the tunneling probability. You say, is the tunneling probability above my random number? Yes. Then you continue with your propagation at this point.
Next step
is at this point now, okay, with zero velocity along the direction of tunneling, whatever velocity it had in the perpendicular before, and life goes on. That's how it goes on. So we don't use it anywhere as well. Effectively, of course, it's like waiting, but it's not waiting in the sense of probability, as you say it, if I understood you correctly. That's what you were asking me, right?
This is somewhat like this random walk stochasticity.
It is like rolling a dice, I said that, yeah. And by the way, yeah.
So your initial
No, but we don't put a zero weight.
No.
In the trajectory, we don't put a zero weight. The trajectory continues,
but
right?
What kind of initial condition at the next point you choose?
At the next point, if it didn't tunnel, it goes on as it was. It reflects. Yeah, we don't artificially put anything there. So when it hits this point, we check if it tunnels. If it tunnels, there is nothing artificial about it. If it tunnels, it's an ad hoc, we're putting something on the tunneling, but there is nothing after that. We are not, you know, playing around. We say you get out, as we do for the first step, you get out with zero velocity along the field.
So where do you get this zero from?
But for tunneling, that's what we assume, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's
a fair question, but also a question for everybody else who is doing...
I don't understand your algorithm.
Ah.
So you are changing the initial condition of the velocities.
Yes.
By deciding whether it has tunneled or not.
Yes.
You are not taking the probability of tunneling yet.
No.
Simply,
I don't know. I am. I'm asking if I'm taking the tunneling probability in order to decide whether it tunnels or it reflects.
Yeah, but your tunneling probability could be 0.9, 0.3. These differences are not there in your consideration. No.
Just a moment, because I didn't understand. If it is 0.93 and I generate a random number between 0 and 1, which is below 0.93, it will take the tunneling step. If it is above, it will not take the tunneling step.
But as soon as you assume that it's tunneling step,
yeah,
you turn off the initial condition of the velocity and put it equal to 0. This is by...
No. But, or no, along the direction of the field.
Yeah, along the direction.
I have to, but that's what everybody does, right? After tunneling, we're assuming. Well, actually, not everybody, because, okay. Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm doing. But that but you see, I wouldn't even say that that's what I'm doing, because that's what pretty much the whole community is doing for tunneling,
that's
right?
That's another issue. I'm not referring
to. Ah, yeah, okay, you're right. How?
I understand the yeah. Algorithm.
That's the algorithm, but I cannot defend. Okay, you're absolutely right. I cannot defend the zero or whatever, but I can't, because it's a whole discussion altogether again. Is it zero? And if I change it and I do a different distribution, they find better agreement for this one electron system that they do. But let me, again, okay, but this I would like to say, because Marcus said something about the tunneling time. I bet, because that's what I have seen, my experience and so on, for these problems, and for these systems that I'm considering, it doesn't make a difference whatsoever, okay? It makes a difference on their level because they are discussing one electron and their problem is how it tunnels and this attosecond dynamics. This is not attosecond dynamics. This is femtosecond dynamics. So even if I'm a little bit off in how I set my initial condition, it will not matter. I have to see, because I'm saying this because I tell you I have a good reason for saying this. Ah, sorry, because I can compare with this. I mean, it's right on with the ab initio result. So it tells me that for double ionization things, it's not so sensitive to the initial conditions in your first tunneling step. For other things, it is, absolutely, but not so much for this.
Okay. Last question.
Okay. I just want the clarification on that last picture. So if you could turn on the mic. So after your electron starts to tunnel, now it's in the tunneling barrier, it no longer interacts with the field, right?
What do you mean? Because it doesn't, what does it mean it starts tunneling? It tunnels or it doesn't tunnel? It
well,
hits this.
It is tunneling now. But while it is tunneling.
That I don't account for.
Okay.
There's no why it is tunneling for me.
Okay.
So it is immediately out.
It's
instantaneous. That's why I said I'm not doing anything with the tunneling times and blah, blah, blah. So it is instantaneous. There's no why it's tunneling. It hits and can either reflect or it shows up here next.
And then you use a distribution.
And then, not a distribution, no, no. It's here, a distribution I use at the starting point. Here it is zero velocity along the direction and the perpendicular is whatever it was as it was coming into the fixed point. So no distribution or nothing, zero, and perpendicular is exactly what it was just before coming in.
Let's thank you, Kathy.